content. Parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 o'clock Eastern Time on Wednesday, November 11th, 2020. Veterans Day, I want to acknowledge those who have served for our country. Your service and sacrifice is acknowledged and appreciated. I try to get away from thanking people because some vets don't care for that, so I'm trying to honor that and say this instead. Thank you for joining us for the 96th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on blogtalkradio.com. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you don't mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Okay, well, that was a kind of a blast from the past, and it's going to be covered a little more in my trivia section because it's related. So that's a song by an artist that folks may remember, even though they see this person as a one-hit wonder. This person is actually still recording to this day and playing, Gilbert O'Sullivan, and the song is Alone Again, Naturally. So since we're talking about being alone, yeah, I thought that would be kind of a interesting little twist on part two of our saga.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's a fun song. I used to listen to that a lot when I was younger. So as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Alone, Loner Behavior and Reclusiveness, Part 2 of 2, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So, kind of tagging along with that little intro, most people probably know Gilbert O'Sullivan is a keyboardist. So, tonight I thought, since I'd focused on a lot of various different artists, and mostly I talk about guitars and amps and stuff, and occasionally I throw in bass players, and of course, last time I talked about drummers, so I thought I'd talk about keyboardists this time. And in specific, keyboardists who also sang. And there's a surprising number of them. And I'm going to list predominantly folks who do it live. And they may also play guitar live, but they also play keyboards almost equally. percentages, and not just folks who play keyboards in the studio, because there's a lot of folks who do that, but typically don't play them live. They're typically guitarist or bassist or something else. So, with that intro, and these will be done alphabetically so as not to appear to favor any one or two artists. So I'll start out with Don Airey, who most people have heard multiple times but don't know they've heard. So Don Airey was the keyboardist for Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow, for Whitesnake, and for Ozzy Osbourne. Has also replaced John Lord after he passed and quit touring and then passed not too long after that in Deep Purple. So he's been the keyboardist ever since, and he also does background vocals. Greg Allman, of course, who does did lead vocals and organ for the Allman Brothers. Rod Argent from The Zombies and from Argent, Hold Your Head Up. All right. Gary Booker from Procol Harum, and also did a tour with Clapton, personal buddies with Clapton. Jackson Brown, who plays piano and guitar. David Bryan, the keyboardist and background vocalist for Bon Jovi. Jonathan Kane, who started out with the Babies and then moved to Bad English and Journey. So he's been Journey's keyboardist for a very, very long time. Ray Charles, of course, who everybody knows. Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon, who also plays guitar, but he plays a lot of keyboards. Dennis DeYoung, the original keyboardist and vocalist for Styx. Thomas Dolby, who plays mostly synthesizers and sings, but still keyboards. Fats Domino, which everybody, of course, knows. And if you don't, you've lived under a rock. Donald Fagen for Steely Dan. Dan Fogelberg, who plays a number of instruments, but predominantly keyboards and guitar. Lawrence Gowan, who replaced the original keyboard player for REO Speedwagon, Kevin Cronin, who has been the Styx keyboardist and vocalist ever since they parted ways with Dennis DeYoung. Billy Joel, of course, who everybody knows. Elton John, everybody, you know, the guys and gals everybody knows. Carole King, who actually started out as part of James Taylor's band, and until she had a hit, and then she went solo, and then she and Taylor, of course, get back together from time to time. Al Cooper, original keyboardist and vocalist for Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Robert Lamb, Chicago Transit Authority's keyboardist, vocalist. Jerry Lee Lewis. Raymond Zarek, Doors, keyboardist and bass player, too, for that matter. When they played live, he would play bass keyboards. And at the one part did background vocals, but after Jim Morrison's passing, took over lead vocals. Michael McDonald for Doobie Brothers and Steely Dan. Christine McVie for Fleetwood Mac, and then she's also done some solo work. So is Michael McDonald, for that matter. Freddie Mercury from Queen. Mike Pender, the original keyboardist and background vocalist from Moody Blues. Gilbert O'Sullivan, who I just mentioned and just played. Steve Picaro for Toto, keyboardist and background vocalist. Billy Preston, who has played for a lot of different people prior to his passing. Most people know him with his work from the Beatles, and then later as the studio and touring keyboard players with Rolling Stones, and then solo work as well. He also toured with Clapton just prior to his passing. Lionel Richie for the Commodores and a solo recording career. Little Richard, which everybody knows. Greg Raleigh, Santana's original keyboardist and vocalist. He's God Sings Black Magic Woman. And for Journey, obviously, he's the first original keyboardist, the one that Jonathan Cain replaced. Leon Russell, who has had both a solo career, has played with Joe Cocker on Bad Dogs and Englishmen, and with Harrison on a lot of his studio work and at the Bangladesh concert. Cat Stevens, who plays both guitar and keyboards, but plays both live and sings. Steve Walsh for Kansas. and the Steve Walsh Band. Steve Winwood, which, of course, everybody and their brother knows, who, you know, started out with the Spencer Davis Group, you know, who sang Give Me Some Lovin'. I think he was like, 15 or 16 at the time, some ridiculous age. You just want to kill people who are that talented. And later for Traffic, and then Blind Faith, and a short stint with Ginger Baker's Air Force. Bill Withers, keyboardist and vocalist, Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone. Stevie Wonder, who also plays harmonica and a bunch of other stuff. Richard Wright, keyboardist and background vocalist and occasional lead vocalist for Pink Floyd. And Warren Zevon, who actually started out playing with the Everly Brothers and eventually got a record deal and did a lot of solo work prior to his demise. So, as you can see, we have a lot more people than most people think that are keyboardists who do vocals.
That's quite an impressive list. Some of those I knew, a few of them I did not, actually. So that was kind of neat. Thank you very much for that.
Sure.
That's one of my favorite parts about us doing the trivia segment, because there's always something fun in there that I had no idea was going on, and that's part of the reason we wanted to showcase all these cool stories that you remember. Okay.
No, thanks. A nerd, it's what you do.
Yeah. I resemble that remark. So anyway, thank you for that. And again, sure. We will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All right, tonight's topic, Alone, Loner Behavior and Reclusiveness, Part 2 of 2. By request of one of our followers, actually a couple of our followers, because we've merged several topics together. Tonight's topic is about comparing and discussing varying forms of loner and reclusive behavior for a variety of reasons. With the 2020 quarantine still in effect, and likely to remain so for several more months, the majority of us are living a somewhat modified but still fairly reclusive lifestyle these days. However, there are several subsets of people who were previously already living in this manner for any one of several reasons. Some people are shy, introverted, misanthropic, or may even be depressed or grieving. Some may have a mental health condition that affects their socialization. Some are slow to mature and become independent and are in a so-called failure to launch scenario, like the movie, still living with their parents. Some have physiological health issues that necessitate their limiting their contact with others, such as people that are immunocompromised. And the list goes on. So on our last show, we got as far as discussing an overview of reclusiveness and being a loner by choice. We also started to get into some of the various terms and definitions of different types of loners and recluses and certain pathologies that go along with it. And we had to stop in the middle because we were getting way over time. So tonight we'll pick that back up and continue with loner by pathology and wrap up with resources for those struggling with social disconnect. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to bring up before we dive in.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
All righty. Let's skip down to the third section where we're talking about different terms. And we had actually wrapped up last time defining recluse. And because that's where we stopped, I'm actually going to go ahead and repeat that. And then we will dive into the rest of the definitions that we did not get to. So, last time we were saying, a recluse is a person who lives in voluntary seclusion from the public and society. Historically, the word referred to a hermit's total isolation from the world, but in modern usage, it has become more inclusive than that. There are many potential reasons for becoming a recluse, including but not limited to a personal philosophy may reject consumer society. A mystical religious outlook may involve becoming a hermit or an anchorite. And last time we had discussed discussed those terms, which actually have a religious meaning and specific. They're used a lot interchangeably, and that's technically not correct. Survivalist may be practicing self-sufficiency. A criminal might hide away from people to avoid detection by police. Or a misanthrope may be unable to tolerate human society in general. It can also be due to psychological reasons, such as being a victim of forms of abuse that cause almost all the following psychological disorders, not necessarily all in one person. Post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety disorder, apathy, autism, depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, intellectual disability, schizoid personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, or avoidant personality disorder. Entrepreneur Kim Smiley had written, "We live in a society that stigmatizes seclusion, yet has an almost rabid fascination with it at the same time." And the reason that I wanted to repeat this definition is because at the end of the show, Dr. Mathis, you had brought up a very interesting point, and I did mention that I thought it might be fun to discuss it. We didn't have time. And that was your comment that people who are kind of obsessed with recluses and loners have some of the same fascination that we have with serial killers. And if you don't mind, I'd like to put you on the spot to expand on that, if you would.
Well, it's just there's a group of people who really get off on taking things like Frosted Flakes and Post Toasties and beating the hell out of the box, you know, serial killers. Okay, so, okay, dude, don't quit your day job.
Dr. Mathis is an invertebrate punster and needs to be punished, but I digress.
Oh, my God, I thought, what do they call that? Irresistible impulse. Sorry, Your Honor. it's funny because we as a society sort of have a fascination with the odd or the eccentric. And, you know, that includes everything from, serial killers to recluses to paranormal phenomena and unusual things to aliens to all sorts of, thing. And we glorify them on a lot of TV shows and movies, which we've talked about before. And in a lot of ways, when you do that, you glamorize them and they become even more, let me find out about that. Life looks kind of cool because you don't really understand what you're seeing. But I just think that we as a society at some point, I think, get bored with our sort of everyday lives unless we do something really exciting and challenging and mind-blowing. And so I think it's sort of a vicarious living through, observational learning, if you will, but you're not trying to imitate anything. Just you're living vicariously through, somebody else who has seems to have a much more exciting or very different lifestyle, kind of like where some of us are fascinated by, other cultures that are just incredibly different from our own and have certain ritualized social behaviors and mores that are very, very different from our own. It's a similar kind of phenomena. And especially when the phenomena is pathologically based and then glorified somehow on TV or movies or whatever, and then people go, "Oh, that looks like a lot of fun," when in fact it really isn't. So that's part of it. That's a large part of it.
Okay, cool. That actually makes sense to me. I just found that to be too interesting to let it go completely. So I thought that might be a fun way to start off.
Yeah. Sure.
All right. Let's go ahead and continue with the rest of our vocabulary terms. These are basically different aspects of loner or recluse behavior, and it's a mix of pathologies and life choices and everything else. I did them in alphabetical order, so that's why they're kind of mixed all together. So the next one that I want to talk about is schizoid personality disorder, often abbreviated as SPD or SZPD. Is a personality disorder characterized by a lack of interest in social relationships, a tendency towards a solitary or sheltered lifestyle, secretiveness, emotional coldness, detachment, and apathy. affected individuals may be unable to form intimate attachments to others and simultaneously possess a rich and elaborate but exclusively internal fantasy world. Other associated features include stilted speech, a lack of deriving enjoyment from most typical activities, feeling as though one is an observer rather than a participant in life, an inability to tolerate emotional expectations of others, apparent indifference when praised or criticized, a degree of asexuality, and idiosyncratic moral or political beliefs. Symptoms typically start in late childhood or adolescence. SPD is a poorly studied disorder, and there is little clinical data on SPD because it's rarely encountered in a clinical setting. And I'm actually going to pause after each one of these and kind of check in with you because this is a little crunchy, so it would be good to take them one at a time. And I wanted to see if you had anything to add about this one in particular.
Yeah, the reason that you don't see it a lot in clinical settings is because most of these folks, to steal a line from Gone with the Wind, frankly, my dear, they don't give a damn. And they're not going to come in expressing angst about their social life because they don't have any, nor do they want one. They're typically much more at home with things, objects, scientific puzzles, as opposed to interacting socially with people. They have just, as you accurately pointed out, they're very indifferent to other folks, praise or criticism, and really just don't want to be involved in, you know, in what they perceive to be as drama, even when it's not drama and when it's really just sort of quote-unquote normal emotional expressions. They just sort of don't get it. They expect people to act like machines and math equations. So when they don't, they just kind of get annoyed and it's like, you know what, I'll just be by myself. I'm better. So that's and that's very, that's a different animal, so to speak, than schizotypal or schizotypal personality disorder, because those folks are sort of in, for lack of a better term, land. And I joke when I'm teaching this to grad students and I say, think of your schizotypals as a typical schizophrenic in a sense, but with no hallucinations and no delusions. So they have all the odd or eccentric behaviors that the schizophrenics do, but they're not crazy, for lack of a better term. And I know that's not an accurate clinical term, but for the, you know, the average non-nerd person, they'll get that. They're, you know, they don't see things and hear things. They don't think the FBI's, you know, got wires connected to their heads and that kind of stuff. But they're just extremely odd or eccentric and really kind of out there in la-la land. And they're not dumb, and they know that they're kind of odd or eccentric. And so they just kind of isolate because they don't want other people to see how utter eccentric they are. They're kind of concerned about that. The schizoidals couldn't give two flips. I mean, they really could not.
Okay.
Right. All right. And schizophrenics are kind of like, and schizophrenics are very much like that too. They isolate, particularly the paranoid schizophrenics, because not only are they uber sensitive to criticism, but they think everybody's out to get them, and you know they do think invisible wires are connected to their heads, and people are stealing their thoughts or inserting their thoughts. And the paranoid schizophrenics tend to be more intellectually gifted. So if you're going to look at a schizophrenic with a higher IQ, it's going to be the paranoid schizophrenics. So they're just smart enough to know how, for lack of a better term, and again, this is inaccurate, just how crazy they are. And then when anybody else seeing it, they're like, no, I'm not getting around these people. They're going to really see how nuts I am. I'm just going to hang back. And besides, they're probably reading my thoughts, and they're probably inserting thoughts, and they're probably stealing my ideas, and I've really got to stay away from them. So schizotypals or schizotypals and the schizoid personality disorder folks are much more similar than they are to the schizoidals, who are just indifferent and kind of, you know, they want to be alone and couldn't give a flip.
You know, this actually raises for me.
Which is different from avoidant personality.
Yeah.
Right, which is different from avoidant personality disorder. So schizotypals and schizoidals are cluster A personality disorders. Yeah, you know, they're in the aliens, as I call it. They're in the cluster A's, right? avoidant personality disorders are in the cluster C's, the cowards, right? The same one that my personality disorder belongs to, the obsessive compulsive personality disorder, right? So we're basically,
gotcha.
Excuse my rude, right? So basically, we're a bunch of chicken shits. That's the other thing C stands for.
So,
right? Well, it's fear based, right? So the avoidant personality disorders would love to be socially active and socially in the milieu, but they are afraid they're going to make mistakes, and then they're going to be uber self-conscious, and so they have all this anxiety about interacting. They want to interact, but they're just scared that they're going to mess something up and they're going to embarrass themselves. And, oh my God, oh my God. The schizoids are the complete opposite of it. They just don't give two flying flips. Just don't bother, you know, go away, you bother me. They just really don't want to be bothered. The social anxiety disorders would love to be bothered, but they're too afraid.
Gotcha. Okay. So as I mentioned a minute ago, this kind of raises a question for me, and this is getting into the minutia a little bit, but I think it's interesting, and some of our listeners might want to know as well.
Yeah, and God knows
so
I'm
earlier,
not interested in any of that.
So earlier I was mentioning that some of the traits include things like stilted speech and being detached from a lot of typical social interaction. So it kind of raised a question about how much crossover or similarities it might have to some forms of being on the spectrum, especially Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of
yeah,
the things
the,
I just listed
as I call
seem
it,
to be
the
on the same
boat. Formally known as.
Right. And you know, you and I have talked extensively about how we kind of hate on the DSM-5 for having merged it, and it's all weird, and we don't really agree with it, but...
Yeah, but they didn't ask us.
So,
those
well,
bastards.
They should have. It was rude. It was so rude. I mean, they should have called us immediately before posting this, you know, like 4 years before we started this show, the nerve.
Yeah, I'm telling you, right?
So if somebody is listening and maybe they're wondering, you know, I feel like maybe I have some kind of issue like Asperger's, but then they might hear this and go, well, or it could be this other thing, like, where would you say you could divide these guys from each other? Like, how would you know
okay,
if you're kind of looking at
you know, that's a really good question. That's a great question, because if you just look at their behavior, and all you see is the external behavior of detachment and kind of clumsiness, if you will, and social awkwardness, there's a better word, socially awkward stuff when they do attempt to interact. The spectrum people have some degree, whether they're autistic or whether they're the disorder formerly known as Asperger's, with or without onions and cheese. those folks at some level want to interact, but they don't know how, and so they kind of do trial and error because they have a lot of cognitive difficulties processing stuff. The schizoidals don't have any cognitive processing issues usually. They just don't give a flip. They're just like, oh, you don't operate like a machine, and if I turn you on, you operate, and if I turn you off, you go away, and two and two isn't always four, and really, you're weird, go away. And the spectrum people want to interact, but they're not quite sure how to do it, and so they make a lot of stabs at it, and because they can't read social cues because of the cognitive perceptual issues, and they don't know how to interpret a lot of social cues. They can't read facial expressions, that kind of thing. They misreact, for lack of a better term. And then people kind of shun them, and they're like, ugh. And then they either get hurt and you know, kind of withdraw, or they get angry and lash out and then withdraw. So the schizoidals don't have cognitive processing or perceptual processing or reasoning issues. The spectrum people do.
Okay. All right, that's actually very helpful. So hopefully that'll also help our listeners if they're kind of listening and going, I wonder if that's me or someone I know. You know, that might help them in starting a meaningful dialogue with a professional to
sure.
see what's going on.
Sure. And if you have a mild case of the spectrum stuff or even a mild case of the schizoidal stuff, let's just say you have schizoidal tendencies but you don't meet the full criteria. So, you know, you might have enough to get a personality disorder, you know, unspecified personality disorder kind of thing. You know, the best thing to do, as you just said, is to go in and check with a professional, because a lot of these things do walk and look and talk and act like each other, particularly on the, if you've got a high end of something that kind of crosses into the low end of another disorder, or you've got a low end of both disorders, you don't know where you stand, or you don't quite meet the criteria for one or the other, but you're kind of this. It's confusing. I mean, I'm the first to tell you it's confusing. Students even have trouble with it. You know, like master's level students even have trouble, and some doctoral students have trouble with it. So there is definitely nothing to be ashamed of in that regard.
Okay, good. So that's very helpful, because then I know a lot of our listeners are, you know, of course, lay people. and so I try to make these things accessible so that they can kind of follow what's going on, because I know we get sort of crunchy on here, and I want to make sure we don't lose people because we're trying to help them out. So.
Absolutely.
All right,
well, and, you know, ultimately this show is about reaching out to the semi-non-nerds and semi-normal people, unlike myself. Oops, did I say that? And, you know, trying to educate folks so they come at this with, you know, a mindful approach, as opposed to, oh, my God, and getting all histrionic and flipping through the DSM going, oh, my God, I've got that. Oh, my God, I've got that. Oh, my God, I've got that. And you probably don't have a third of the stuff you think you have. Right?
Yeah.
And now you're all anxious and isolating.
Yeah. Well, and even doing too much of that is unto itself is technically a pathology too. So.
Oh my Lord. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole nother show. We'll get to that one later. All right. Let's
yes,
go
ma'am.
Ahead and keep going with our terminology. And the next one is singleton. And this is considered a lifestyle term. Singleton is a term for human beings who live in a single person household, especially those who prefer the lifestyle of living alone. And here's where it comes in. It was popularized by the Bridget Jones novels and films, but has also now become a term that's used in sociology. Sociologist Eric Kleinenberg reports that before the 1950s, no society has had large numbers of people living alone. And I found that very interesting because I did not realize that till this got brought up. Historically, this has happened when elderly people outlive their spouses and when men have migrated for work. In modern times, large numbers of people have begun to live happily alone in cities and with the help of communication technologies like, you know, telephone, email, and social networking services, you know, social media and so on. Kleinenberg has found that the ability of women to work, own property, and initiate divorce creates more opportunities for living alone. In countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, where women do not have autonomy, relatively few people live alone. The number of people who live alone is correlated with how wealthy their country is. In wealthy countries, people are more likely to choose the privacy, individualism, and sometimes the loneliness of living alone. And I understand this point, you know, because living alone, you have to be able to be in charge of the whole property or place that you're in. You're not sharing those responsibilities or those costs with anybody else, not a roommate or, you know, any of that other kind of stuff. You have to do it all. You have to fix it all. You have to pay for it all and so forth. And so that's not something that people who are economically disadvantaged can do. And also people who live in countries where they don't have democratic or, you know, republic freedom to do things like that. Their culture or their laws don't allow it. So this is where it gets kind of interesting, living alone. There's a whole lot of factors involved here. But anyhow, that term comes from the Bridget Jones movies, but it's actually crept into sociology now as a real term. So, Dr. Mathis, do you have anything that you want to add on this before we go on?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Next, social anxiety is nervousness in social situations. Some disorders associated with the social anxiety spectrum include anxiety disorders, mood disorders, autistic spectrum disorders, eating disorders, interestingly, and substance use disorders. Anything you want to add with this? That's a short one.
The eating disorders are do alone stuff so other people won't see that they're not eating and that they're binging and they're purging when they're forced to eat. So it's kind of a way to hide their pathology.
Got it.
The substance, right? Substance use disorders to some degree are the same way, because if you're trying to hide your substance abuse, you don't want a bunch of people around unless they're substance abusers, right? And anxiety is sort of at the core of all this aloneness, if it's a pathology stuff, because you're just afraid, you know, you're stressed out and afraid. And so whether you have social anxiety / social phobia, or whether you have avoidant personality disorder or whatever, a lot of that stuff's built, you know, based out of fear of other people finding out about your stuff, or low self-esteem and don't want other people to validate what you believe to be true about yourself. And if you have the mood disorders like bipolar or major depression, anxiety and depression are often co-partners in the same person. And if you've got depression, even if you have any inclination to go out and do things, you don't have the physical or emotional energy to do it. So it's just easier to stay at home.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. All right. So the next one is social isolation. And that is a state of complete or near complete lack of contact between an individual and society. It differs from loneliness, which reflects temporary and involuntary lack of contact with other humans in the world. Social isolation can be an issue for individuals of any age, though symptoms may differ by age group. Social isolation is both a potential cause and or a symptom of emotional or psychological challenges. As a cause, the perceived inability to interact with the world and others can create an escalating pattern of these challenges. As a symptom, periods of isolation can be chronic or episodic depending on any cyclical changes in mood, especially in the case of clinical depression. And do you have anything you want to add to this, Dr. Mathis?
Yeah, that's definitely true. Or if you're in the uber depressed phase of a bipolar disorder.
Okay, good. Alrighty. So the last one is solitude. Solitude is a state of seclusion or isolation, i.e., lack of contact with people. It can have both positive and negative effects depending on the situation. Short-term solitude is often valued as a time when one may work, think, or rest without being disturbed. It may be desired for the sake of privacy. Undesirable or long-term solitude may stem from bad relationships, loss of loved ones, deliberate choice, infectious disease, mental disorders, neurological disorders, or circumstances of employment or living situation. A distinction has been made between solitude and loneliness. In this sense, these two words refer respectively to the joy and the pain of being alone. And I'll check in with you one more time, see if there's anything else that you want to bring up with that.
Yeah, usually you see if it's enforced, if, for lack of a better term, selected self-enforced solitude. Sometimes it's due to, you know, somebody is purging themselves or doing a life review or doing it for some kind of religious or spiritual existential purposes, and then they'll go back to doing their normal thing, whatever that is.
Okay, that makes sense. Good. Thank you. All right,
sure.
So the next section we want to talk about is resources for those struggling with social disconnect. And I do have to let you guys know, and I'll get into explaining why, we don't really have a long list of formal resources like, you know, a bunch of websites or numbers you can call. There are not many dedicated resources for people who are loners or recluses. There are such a wide variety of causes and circumstances, and any support resources would be most likely directed towards these things, helping people with the specific circumstances behind their separation, be it medical, social, financial, or other reasons. So what one can do to help is entirely connected to whether or not one is unhappy with this status and willingly wants to change it. There are many who do not. There are some who struggle with it because of a pathology out of their control, and they might benefit from a few suggestions if they seek to overcome it. And as we mentioned earlier, there's even a couple of pathologies that more or less render you indifferent to bothering. And, you know, in that case, it's very difficult to get anybody to ask. All right. So many people who sequester themselves don't ever seek help directly, nor do they want it. Related or connected persons, in other words, you know, friends, family, neighbors, that sort of thing, can try to seek help on that person's benefit if there's any evidence of harm or neglect due to the behavior. But otherwise, there's not really much to be done unless the person asks for assistance, you know, lead a horse to water and all that. A trusted mental health professional is likely the best starting place in order to identify the nature of the circumstances before intervention. I know that sounds a little bit cart before the horse, but that's the best place to start to understand what you're dealing with here, because the next steps that you take can vary widely depending on what's actually going on.
Actually, it's not.
Really?
It's not as much cart before the horse as you might think. So I'll give you a really good example, because this this just happened to me today.
Okay.
Talk about good timing, right? So long story short, I got a referral from a local place, and the referral was for someone who is in their treatment program but who needs an evaluation to see what's going on with this person cognitively, emotionally, whatever. The person has really expressed no interest in getting this, and I think part of it, based on what I'm understanding, part of it's probably out of fear, but this person's, you know, trying to give them the I don't really care kind of thing. Like, this person's an adolescent, and, you know, that's real typical for adolescents who are defended. So the referral source said, hey, is it okay if I get the parents to call you for some suggestions and ideas? And I went, sure. So the parents call me. And, you know, the parents are concerned that this person might have a spectrum disorder or might have this or might have that, and they're looking for some ways to, for lack of a better term, entice and encourage their kid to come in to let somebody like me evaluate them to see the nature of their stuff and what can be done about it, or even if there's something to be done about it. And I, you know, and I said to the parent, this is a really good idea, because before you start, you know, slapping labels on somebody and potentially slapping medication in their face, and this person is vehemently opposed to medication, and that to me tells me it's a smart person. But anyway, you know, I said to the parent, I said, this is a really, you know, kudos to you for calling, because you want to get some, you know, ways to find out before you just start assuming this person has A, B, or C, or D. So here's how you might want to approach your kid. And, you know, why don't you send your kid to, if you have the website of some professionals you're considering, and they said, well, the person that runs the program really, you know, highly recommended you and that you work a lot with kids. And I said, I do. I said, well, here's my website. Why don't you tell your kid to go check my website out? I said, and just for S and G's, if your kid's kind of eccentric or weird or whatever, I've got an even better idea. Send your kid to my radio show website, because if your kid's eccentric, your kid's going to go, dude, that guy's kind of funky. I think I might go to him, right? And the mom laughed. And I gave the mom my radio show, this radio show website. And so I thought that was a really, really smart idea from the treatment provider who's working with this kid in a sort of an aggressive outpatient status, and to the mom to approach the kid as a way to get this person in to see me so we can find out what it is. And then part of it is, you know, as a professional, when somebody like this comes in, you know, if you're attuned to the fact that they're kind of hypersensitive about being evaluated, then, you know, you try to do it in a way that, for lack of a better term, transmits the data to them, gives them the message that, hey, look, I'm just here to find out, you know, what's going on, and it may just be your personality style if it is. Okay, fine. And it may be that something else is going on. If that's the case, then you have options, because now you have information, and now you can make a rational decision as opposed to making a decision out of fear or anger or ignorance. And this way you know what you're dealing with. And then if you still go, well, that's real nice, but screw all you people, I'm out of here. Okay, but at least you know what you're up against, if anything. And then if you don't really have anything funky, it's just kind of a personality style and quirk, you're going to tell the rest of us to go pound sand and leave you alone, right? And that's just a really cool thing to say to somebody, because then they're not feeling like they're under the microscope. And, oh, you're a doctor, so you're going to find it. You're going to find something wrong with me. No, that's not the case. But, you know, who knows what kind of previous experiences this person has had with folks in the medical and or mental health fields. So the mom calling me and dad calling me in advance at the behest of the treatment provider, that was a really smart maneuver. So I really don't see that as putting the cart before the horse, particularly somebody who you care about who may be reluctant to come in and talk about stuff.
All right. Well, that's fair. I'll take it then. You know, that's good. You know, I feel better about recommending that.
Okay, yeah, I thought that was really smart. Yeah.
Cool. As I was saying, let me find my place now. Sorry about that. I was in the middle of a paragraph. Okay, so a trusted mental health professional is likely the best starting place in order to identify the nature of the circumstances before intervention, like I said earlier. If you lack medical coverage for professional help or do not have a professional that's a good fit for you, we encourage you to enlist the help of a trusted friend or other helpful adult in compiling a list of options for you, activities you would like to learn to enjoy or maybe once did enjoy, places you may want to visit as long as that travel is safe for you in current circumstances. You know, with the quarantine, we've got to be careful with that.
Absolutely.
Another option, at the risk of a shameless plug, which we don't do too often, is to consider scheduling a consultation with Dr. Mathis online, because he does do... No,
I didn't see that
now,
one
you
coming.
Know, yes, you did. I sent you the script. So Dr. Mathis does video and phone consults anywhere nationally, and the going rate can be very manageable compared to what in-office psychologists visit. He could assist you in coming up with a plan to overcome loner behaviors that is relevant to your specific circumstances. And the whole reason I bring this up is I know a lot of you have had the same kinds of problems that, you know, I've had, where either you can't find a mental health professional that really hears you and is listening to you. I've been through a very long list of them that want to have the conversation they're having and are not listening to the conversation I'm having. And I've had a lot of people complain about that. And when everybody was doing things physically in person, you were stuck with who's in your area. But now that so many things have gone virtual, and you've been doing the virtual thing for a couple of years now.
I've been doing the telemental health with, you know, folks in state, and every now and then, you know, out, you know, I have folks that used to be here that'll move away and they'll do, you know, a check-in every 3 or 4 months kind of thing for probably 10
right.
years. And so I, you know, I've got a secure server and all that kind of stuff. And the other thing I would say to people is, you know, if you just want to call and talk for 5 or 10 minutes and say, hey, look, we don't necessarily want to engage your services, but we'd like some ideas about, here's what we got. Do you have some ideas for us? And I'm happy to spend 10, 15 minutes on the phone and say, okay, here's the things you want to look for in your area. And it's funny, I don't know if I ever told you this story. It's kind of related to this, that this mm-hmm. was, gosh, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. I got a call from someone out of Texas who was referred to me by their clinician, who saw my website and thought, oh, this guy's perfect for this kid, and, you know, did a web search for adolescent therapists. So gave the mom my phone number, and the mom called me, and I called the mom back, and I'm thinking, wow, this isn't local. But, you know, I thought, okay, well, the mom's some business executive for AT&T or whatever, and the mom just moved to Georgia. You know, so I'm talking on the phone. And the mom goes, wait a minute. And I hear her clicking on the way. She goes, oh, my God, you're in Atlanta. And I went, uh-huh. And if I were Seth, I'd go, and your point is what? You know, not wanting to be Mr. Smartass, so, for a change. I said, yes, that's absolutely true. She goes, yeah, really. She's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I just wasted 15 minutes of your time talking about my kid. And we're in, you know, Austin or wherever the heck this person was. I said, now you haven't wasted my time. I'm happy to help you. I said, and here's some things you want to look for in therapists in your area. And so this gal was taking notes. Right. And she's like, oh, that's so cool. She goes, but you really would be perfect for my kid because he's into rock music. And I saw your picture and you got the hair and you look like a musician. I'm like, well, there's a good reason for that. Right. She goes, oh, you should talk to my girlfriend. She collects Beatle guitars. You know, she collects Rickenbackers because Beatles played Rickenbackers in the early days and da da da. So I'm going to get her to. If you wouldn't mind, I'd love to give her your phone number. You guys would love to connect. So the girlfriend calls me up. And then a couple of days later, and we're talking, and I said, yeah, well, I'm a collector, and I love talking. So she calls me, we're talking stuff. Well, long story short, she ends up she plays guitar. She's got like, I don't know, 15 or 20 Rickenbackers, the Beatle era. And she decided to buy a 75th anniversary Rickenbacker bass because it was real pretty, and quote unquote. And it's a pretty guitar. And, and she says, now I was going to learn to play bass, but I decided that was kind of hard and it looks really pretty, but I should probably sell it. And I go, the kind of cherry, kind of sparkle, like wine color. She goes, yeah, it's kind of cherry red. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's one of the 75th anniversary Rickenbackers. She goes, yeah, it's got that on the pick guard, da 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 da. And so long story short, she sold it to me for some ridiculous price. And there's literally 75 of those in the world. And so it showed up on my doorstep I sent her a check and it showed me up on my doorstep about 2 weeks later. And I got it for a ridiculously good price, like probably cheaper than it sold for when she bought it. And she'd never played it. It was still in the case with all the paperwork in it and stuff. And I was laughing. And I said to one of my buddies, I said, this is the universe thanking me for helping the other woman with her kid. Right? And I joke about it, but you really never know. And honestly, for me, it was really cool for me to help this other person, you know, with some criteria to help her find a good therapist for her kid, because she said she's already tried a couple of therapists and they were the, you know, traditional, you know, stick in the mud types. And like you said, weren't listening to the kid. The kid got very frustrated. And I'm like, well, duh, nobody likes to not be listened to. Come on. You know? So anyway, it was just interesting. And you say that, and that kind of tangential story came up and of how I ended up with the 75th anniversary Rickenbacker bass, just being kind of a nice guy, you know? And so if any of the listeners want to do that, and particularly if you have like a very rare guitar, but seriously, don't order yet. Now, I just really like helping connect people with the right people. You know, and if I can be of assistance to that, I don't care if you're seeing somebody in your area. If you're seeing the right person, that's great. You know, I get off on that.
And, you know, sometimes a lot of people, it's such a struggle for people who don't really have a mental health professional in their area that they click with to just get the straight answer. How many times have you told stories on this show about people that come to you and they were misdiagnosed or the test was done in a funky way and they've been chasing some of a tree. Yes, exactly. And all these things that could have been solved by 15 minutes with somebody who's not a fucking idiot. Sorry. And just to get
that.
That
was your unmedicated voice.
That was my This Is a Rated R Show voice.
There you go.
And that's why.
But you're absolutely right.
Yeah,
but you're absolutely right. If people took the time in my business, and I mean no disrespect to any of my colleagues or peers, but if people took the time to do, for lack of a better term, the right thing instead of the quote-unquote standard of care, which I think is woefully inadequate in a lot of cases, people would not be suffering as much as they are. And, you know, you get to the problem quicker and everybody would be happy and it would be a win-win. And to me, that's a no-brainer, really.
Yes. And so that was a very long way of basically saying, you know, if you guys could just arrange for that, if it's a professional, if you got a good friend you can talk to, that's great. But if there isn't anybody else, that is something that we can arrange for you. And if you don't know how to do it, you can get on our website or on our Facebook page and just message them, catch the messages. You know, I do admin stuff for Dr. Mathis that way. We do social media and things. So we'll be happy to hook you up where somebody can give you a straight frickin' answer for 10 minutes. You can figure out what you need to go do. Because having the wrong answer will waste years of your time and your pathologies will just take over. So
which is not good.
No. So, and one more suggestion that we can make to those who may be friends or family of someone who is in a loner situation and would rather not be, that's the important part, is to take advantage of the myriad online chats and connecting apps to have a semi-regular check-in time. Maybe do a watch party or a game or some other activity altogether. Maybe one of you can read a story or a book chapter and put it on Zoom or YouTube. Just be mindful of copyrights when you do that stuff for people to see. Schedule a breakfast or lunch by video. I had a friend do this to me this afternoon, and I thought it was like the coolest freaking thing ever. So this is somebody I've known online. I've met three or four times because they're in Virginia, just elsewhere. And we haven't had a chance to catch up for a while. So next Tuesday morning, we're having breakfast together on Zoom. So get my little tea and cereal, and we'll just sit down and chit-chat, you know, like we would at the coffee table, but we'll just be online. And, you know, when she brought it up, I'm like, it's so simple, and that's just the coolest thing ever because I'm sitting in the house by myself lately. Burglars don't get any cute ideas because I have concealed carry. but, you know, it was just really nice to that simple thing because we're in an era right now, and we may still be for a few months, where that kind of basic contact is going to be very difficult to find in person. And so these kinds of things, if you are in a isolated, loner, recluse situation and you do give a shit and you do want to be doing something else, these kinds of things might sound a little hokey, but they are really kind of good for pulling you out of that funk. So, you know, I have another friend that has a YouTube channel and he's constantly reading, like, you know, film noir type books, you know, the Raymond Chandler kind of things or, you know, that sort of stuff. And we'll read a chapter or two at a time, and it's about an hour. And it's kind of nice. I actually made a little playlist on YouTube, so I chained them all together so I can just go to sleep to my friend reading a cool book. And these things are really good to help cope with the isolation while we're stuck and there's a limit to what we can do about it. It gives the illusion that people are here with us. And in a way, they really are. I mean, it's not like it's a lie. It's just, you know, kind of simulated. But, you know, look for these kinds of things to do with your friends. Suggest them. Put yourself out there. You know, let somebody know who wants to have breakfast on Zoom. You know, instead of sitting around waiting for somebody to suggest it, go be the person that brings it up. Because you might have a friend who really wants to do something else but doesn't know how. It's awkward or they're embarrassed or whatever. So if you make the first move, it takes the heat off. So that's my last suggestion on that. You know, we do visits in the yard or on the front porch while weather still allows. Just make it well known through social media or email somebody, text them, give them a phone call, let them know you're happy to do something. And hopefully the estranged person will take you up on it. You can't really force them, but if you let them know that that's an option, then they'll start chewing on it and maybe they'll come around. So I'm going to check in with you one last time, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else you want to bring up because we're getting close to the top of the hour.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So fabulous. Hopefully that was helpful to you guys. In conclusion, we hope now that our listeners better understand loner behavior and reclusiveness in its many forms. This can be a difficult situation to navigate, both for the person experiencing it and for others connected to or concerned about them. So hopefully tonight provided our listeners with better clarity and a starting place to address any concerns. So I've checked in with Dr. Mathis, so let's go ahead and wrap up. On behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who maybe have been joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc., you know, the website. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion. That'll be Wednesday, November 25th, day before Thanksgiving here in America at 11 p.m. Eastern Time right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. So Travel Itch Radio usually follows us Thursday night. That's the 12th this week, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Travelers who need more space may take that word literally by looking up at the heavens and considering celestial tourism. So says Valerie Steinach, author of Dark Skies, a practical guide to astrotourism, published last September by Lonely Planet. She'll share her love of space, the stars, and the future when she talks with host and executive producer Dan Schlossberg and co-host Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee. On Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday Morning Extravaganza. That'll be the 14th, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday Morning Quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. You guys know the rest of the drill. Jeff Track is back Saturday the 14th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Jeff Track with Captain Jeff returns and guest co-host Admiral Roger Noriega. And last but not least, I am seeing a second show behind your back. I'm just kidding. Fear the Walking Dead and World Beyond online viewing party Sunday, November 15th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Fear the Walking Dead Season 6, Episode 6, Bury Her Next to Jasper's Leg. And The Walking Dead World Beyond Season 1, Episode 7, Truth or Dare. Please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. See you next time. And rock on. Good night.